He blasted his way through the middle of them, running as the bodies fell, his hands picking the targets with dreadful accuracy. Two men and a woman went down, and he ran through the hole they left. He led them a feverish parade across the street and toward the rickety general store barber shop that faced Sheb's. He mounted the boardwalk, turned again, and fired the rest of his loads into the charging crowd. Behind them, Sheb and Allie and the others lay crucified in the dust. They never hesitated or faltered, although every shot he fired found a vital spot, and although they had probably never seen a gun except for pictures in old magazines. He retreated, moving his body like a dancer to avoid the flying missiles. He reloaded as he went, with a rapidity that had also been trained into his fingers. They shuttled busily between gun belts and cylinders. The mob came up over the boardwalk, and he stepped into the general store and rammed the door closed. The large display window to the right shattered inward, and three men crowded through. Their faces were zealously blank, their eyes filled with bland fire. He shot them all and the two that followed them. They fell in the window, hung on the jutting shards of glass, choking the opening. The door crashed and shuddered with their weight, and he could hear her voice. "The killer! Your souls! The cloven hoof!" The door ripped off its hinges and fell straight in, making a flat hand clap. Dust puffed up from the floor. Men, women, and children charged him. Spittle and stovewood flew. He shot his guns empty, and they fell like ninepins. He retreated, shoving over a flour barrel, rolling it at them, into the barber shop, throwing a pan of boiling water that contained two nicked straight razors. They came on, screaming with frantic incoherency. From somewhere, Sylvia Pittston exhorted them, her voice rising and falling on blind inflections. He pushed shells into hot chambers, smelling the smells of shave and tonsure, smelling his own flesh as the calluses at the tips of his fingers singed. He went through the back door and onto the porch. The flat scrubland was at his back now, flatly denying the town that crouched against its huge haunch. Three men hustled around the corner, with large betrayer grins on their faces. They saw him seeing them, and the grins curdled in the second before he mowed them down. A woman had followed them, howling. She was large and fat, and known to the patrons of Sheb's as Aunt Mill. The gunslinger blew her backwards, and she landed in a whorish sprawl, her skirt kinked up between her thighs. He went down the steps and walked backwards into the desert, 10 paces, 20. The back door of the barber shop flew open and they boiled out. He caught a glimpse of Sylvia Pittston. He opened up. They fell in squats. They fell backwards. They tumbled over the railing into the dust. They cast no shadows in the deathless purple light of the day. He realized he was screaming. He had been screaming all along. His eyes felt like cracked ball bearings. His balls had drawn up against his belly. His legs were wood. His ears were iron. The guns were empty, and they boiled at him, transmogrified into an eye and a hand, and he stood screaming and reloading, his mind far away and absent, letting his hands do their reloading trick. Could he hold up a hand, tell them he had spent 25 years learning this trick, and others, tell them of the guns and the blood that had blessed them? Not with his mouth, but his hands could speak their own tale. They were in throwing range as he finished reloading, and a stick struck him on the forehead and brought blood in abraded drops. In 2 seconds they would be in gripping distance. In the forefront he saw Kennerly, Kennerly's younger daughter, perhaps 11, Subi, 2 male barflies, a female barfly named Amy Felden. He let them all have it, and the ones behind them. Their bodies thumped like scarecrows, blood and brains flew in streamers. They halted for a moment, startled, the mob face shivering into individual, bewildered faces. A man ran in a large, screaming circle. A woman with blisters on her hands turned her head up and cackled feverishly at the sky. The man whom he had first seen sitting gravely on the steps of the mercantile store made a sudden and amazing load in his pants. He had time to reload one gun. Then it was Sylvia Pittston, running at him, waving a wooden cross in each hand.
"Devil! Devil! Devil! Child killer! Monster! Destroy him, brothers and sisters! Destroy the child-killing interloper!"
He put a shot into each of the cross-pieces, blowing the roods to splinters and four more into the woman's head. She seemed to accordion into herself and waver like a shimmer of heat. They all stared at her for a moment in tableau, while the gunslinger's fingers did their reloading trick. The tips of his fingers sizzled and burned. Neat circles were branded into the tips of each one. There were less of them now. He had run through them like a mower's scythe. He thought they would break with the woman dead, but someone threw a knife. The hilt struck him squarely between the eyes and knocked him over. They ran at him in a reaching, vicious clot. He fired his guns empty again, lying in his own spent shells. His head hurt, and he saw large brown circles in front of his eyes. He missed one shot, downed 11. But they were on him, the ones that were left. He fired the four shells he had reloaded, and then they were beating him, stabbing him. He threw a pair of them off his left arm and rolled away. His hands began doing their infallible trick. He was stabbed in the shoulder. He was stabbed in the back. He was hit across the ribs. He was stabbed in the ass. A small boy squirmed at him and made the only deep cut across the bulge of his calf. The gunslinger blew his head off. They were scattering, and he let them have it again. The ones left began to retreat toward the sand-colored, pitted buildings, and still the hands did their trick, like overeager dogs that want to do their rolling-over trick for you not once or twice, but all night, and the hands were cutting them down as they ran. The last one made it as far as the steps of the barbershop's back porch, and then the gunslinger's bullet took him in the back of the head. Silence came back in, filling jagged spaces. The gunslinger was bleeding from perhaps 20 different wounds, all of them shallow except for the cut across his calf. He bound it with a strip of shirt and then straightened and examined his kill. They trailed in a twisted, zigzagging path from the back door of the barber shop to where he stood. They lay in all positions. None of them seemed to be sleeping. He followed them back, counting as he went. In the general store, one man lay with his arms wrapped lovingly around the cracked candy jar he had dragged down with him. He ended up where he had started, in the middle of the deserted main street. He had shot and killed 39 men, 14 women, and 5 children. He had shot and killed everyone in Tull. A sickish, sweet odor came to him on the first of the dry, stirring wind. He followed it, then looked up and nodded. The decaying body of Nort was spread-eagled atop the plank roof of Sheb's, crucified with wooden pegs. Mouth and eyes were open. A large and purple cloven hoof had been pressed into the skin of his grimy forehead. He walked out of town. His mule was standing in a clump of weed about 40 yards out along the remnant of the coach road. The gunslinger led it back to Kennerly's stable. Outside, the wind was playing a jagtime tune. He put the mule up and went back to Sheb's. He found a ladder in the back shed, went up to the roof, and cut Nort down. The body was lighter than a bag of sticks. He tumbled it down to join the common people. Then he went back inside, ate hamburgers, and drank 3 beers, while the light failed and the sand began to fly. That night he slept in the bed where he and Allie had lain. He had no dreams. The next morning the wind was gone, and the sun was its usual bright and forgetful self. The bodies had gone south like tumbleweeds with the wind. At mid-morning, after he had bound all his cuts, he moved on as well. 18. He thought Brown had fallen asleep. The fire was down to a spark, and the bird, Zoltan, had put his head under his wing. Just as he was about to get up and spread a pallet in the corner, Brown said, "There. You've told it. You feel better?" The gunslinger started. "Why would I feel bad?"
"You're human,
he said. No demon. Or did you lie?
I didn't lie.
He felt the grudging admittance in him. He liked Brown, honestly did, and he hadn't lied to the dweller in any way.
Who are you, Brown? Really, I mean.
Just me, he said, unperturbed.
Why do you have to think you're such a mystery?
The gunslinger lit a smoke without replying.
I think you're very close to your man in black, Brown said.
Is he desperate?
I don't know.
Are you?
Not yet, the gunslinger said.
He looked at Brown with a shade of defiance.
I do what I have to do.
That's good, then, Brown said, and turned over and went to sleep.
19. In the morning, Brown fed him and sent him on his way. In the daylight, he was an amazing figure, with his scrawny, burnt chest, pencil-like collarbones, and ringleted shock of red hair. The bird perched on his shoulder.
The mule? The gunslinger asked.
I'll eat it, Brown said.
Okay.
Brown offered his hand, and the gunslinger shook it. The dweller nodded to the south.
Walk easy.
You know it. They nodded at each other, and then the gunslinger walked away, his body festooned with guns and water. He looked back once. Brown was rooting furiously at his little corn bed. The crow was perched on the low roof of his dwelling like a gargoyle.
20. The fire was down, and the stars had begun to pale off. The wind walked restlessly. The gunslinger twitched in his sleep and was still again. He dreamed a thirsty dream. In the darkness, the shape of the mountains was invisible. The thoughts of guilt had faded. The desert had baked them out. He found himself thinking more and more about Cort, who had taught him to shoot instead. Cort had known black from white. He stirred again and awoke. He blinked at the dead fire with its own shape superimposed over the other, more geometrical one. He was a romantic. He knew it. And he guarded the knowledge jealously. That, of course, made him think of Cort again. He didn't know where Cort was. The world had moved on. The gunslinger shouldered his tote sack and moved on with it. 2. A nursery rhyme had been playing itself through his mind all day. The maddening kind of thing that will not let go, that stands mockingly outside the apse of the conscious mind and makes faces at the rational being inside. The rhyme was, "The rain in Spain falls mainly on the plain. There is joy and also pain, but the rain in Spain falls mainly on the plain. Pretty plain, loony sane, the ways of the world all will change, and all the ways remain the same. But if you're mad or only sane, the rain in Spain falls mainly on the plain. We walk in love but fly in chains, and the plains in Spain fall mainly in the rain." He knew why the rhyme had occurred to him. There had been the recurring dream of his room in the castle, and of his mother who had sung it to him as he lay solemnly in the tiny bed by the window of many colors. She did not sing it at bedtimes, because all small boys born to the high speech must face the dark alone. But she sang to him at nap times, and he could remember the heavy gray rainlight that shivered into colors on the counterpane. He could feel the coolness of the room and the heavy warmth of blankets, love for his mother and her red lips, the haunting melody of the little nonsense lyric, and her voice. Now it came back, maddeningly, like prickly heat, chasing its own tail in his mind as he walked. All his water was gone, and he knew he was very likely a dead man. He had never expected it to come to this, and he was sorry.
Since noon he had been watching his feet rather than watching the way ahead. Out here even the devil grass had grown stunted and yellow. The hard pan had disintegrated in places to mere rubble. The mountains were not noticeably clearer, although 16 days had passed since he had left the hut of the last homesteader, a loony, sane young man on the edge of the desert. He had had a raven, the gunslinger remembered, but he couldn't remember the raven's name. He watched his feet move up and down, listened to the nonsense rhyme sing itself into a pitiful garble in his mind, and wondered when he would fall down for the first time. He didn't want to fall, even though there was no one to see him. It was a matter of pride. A gunslinger knows pride, that invisible bone that keeps the neck stiff. He stopped and looked up suddenly. It made his head buzz, and for a moment his whole body seemed to float. The mountains dreamed against the far horizon, but there was something else up ahead, something much closer. Perhaps only 5 miles away. He squinted at it, but his eyes were sandblasted and going glare blind. He shook his head and began to walk again. The rhyme circled and buzzed. About an hour later he fell down and skinned his hands. He looked at the tiny beads of blood on his flaked skin with unbelief. The blood looked no thinner. It looked mutely viable. It seemed almost as smug as the desert. He dashed the drops away, hating them blindly. Smug? Why not? The blood was not thirsty. The blood was being served. The blood was being made sacrifice unto. Blood sacrifice. All the blood needed to do was run, and run, and run. He looked at the splotches that had landed on the hard pan and watched as they were sucked up with uncanny suddenness. How do you like that, blood? How does that grab you? Oh, Jesus, you're far gone. He got up, holding his hands to his chest, and the thing he had seen earlier was almost in front of him, startling a cry out of him, a dust-choked crow croak. It was a building. No, two buildings surrounded by a fallen rail fence. The wood seemed old, fragile to the point of elvishness. It was wood being transmogrified into sand. One of the buildings had been a stable. The shape was clear and unmistakable. The other was a house, or an inn. A way station for the coach line. The tottering sand house, the wind had crusted the wood with grit until it looked like a sandcastle that the sun had beat upon at low tide and hardened into a temporary abode, cast a thin line of shadow, and someone sat in the shadow, leaning against the building, and the building seemed to lean with the burden of his weight. Him, then, at last, the man in black. The gunslinger stood with his hands to his chest, unaware of his declamatory posture, and gawped. And instead of the tremendous winging excitement he had expected, or perhaps fear or awe, there was nothing but the dim, atavistic guilt for the sudden, raging hate of his own blood moments earlier, and the endless ring-a-rosy of the childhood song. The rain in Spain, he moved forward, drawing one gun, falls mainly on the plain. He came the last quarter mile at the run, not trying to hide himself. There was nothing to hide behind. His short shadow raced him. He was not aware that his face had become a gray and grinning death mask of exhaustion. He was aware of nothing but the figure in the shadow. It did not occur to him until later that the figure might even have been dead. He kicked through one of the leaning fence rails, it broke in two without a sound, almost apologetically, and lunged across the dazzled and silent stable yard, bringing the gun up. "You're covered! You're covered! You're—" The figure moved restlessly and stood up. The gunslinger thought, "My God, he is worn away to nothing! What's happened to him?" Because the man in black had shrunk 2 full feet, and his hair had gone white. He paused, struck dumb, his head buzzing tunelessly. His heart was racing at a lunatic rate, and he thought, "I'm dying right here." He sucked the white-hot air into his lungs and hung his head for a moment.
When he raised it again, he saw it wasn't the man in black, but a small boy with sun-bleached hair, regarding him with eyes that did not even seem interested. The gunslinger stared at him blankly, and then shook his head in negation. But the boy survived his refusal to believe. He was still there, wearing blue jeans with a patch on one knee and a plain brown shirt of rough weave. The gunslinger shook his head again and started for the stable with his head lowered, gun still in hand. He couldn't think yet. His head was filled with motes, and there was a huge, thrumming ache building in it. The inside of the stable was silent and dark and exploding with heat. The gunslinger stared around himself with huge, floating wall eyes. He made a drunken about-face and saw the boy standing in the ruined doorway, staring at him. A huge lancet of pain slipped dreamily into his head, cutting from temple to temple, dividing his brain like an orange. He reholstered his gun, swayed, put out his hands as if to ward off phantoms, and fell over on his face. When he woke up, he was on his back, and there was a pile of light, odorless hay beneath his head. The boy had not been able to move him, but he had made him reasonably comfortable. And he was cool. He looked down at himself and saw that his shirt was dark with moisture. He licked at his face and tasted water. He blinked at it. The boy was hunkered down beside him. When he saw the gunslinger's eyes were open, he reached behind him and gave the gunslinger a dented tin can filled with water. He grasped it with trembling hands and allowed himself to drink a little, just a little. When that was down and sitting in his belly, he drank a little more. Then he spilled the rest over his face and made shocked blowing noises. The boy's pretty lips curved in a solemn little smile. "Want something to eat?" "Not yet," the gunslinger said. There was still a sick ache in his head from the sunstroke, and the water sat uneasily in his stomach, as if it did not know where to go.
"Who are you?"
"My name is John Chambers. You can call me Jake." The gunslinger sat up, and the sick ache became hard and immediate. He leaned forward and lost a brief struggle with his stomach.
"There's more,"
Jake said. He took the can and walked toward the rear of the stable. He paused and smiled back at the gunslinger uncertainly. The gunslinger nodded at him and then put his head down and propped it with his hands. The boy was well-made, handsome, perhaps 9. There had been a shadow on his face, but there were shadows on all faces now. A strange thumping hum began at the rear of the stable, and the gunslinger raised his head alertly, hands going to gun butts. The sound lasted for perhaps 15 seconds, and then quit. The boy came back with the can, filled now. The gunslinger drank sparingly again, and this time it was a little better. The ache in his head was fading.
"I didn't know what to do with you when you fell down," Jake said. "For a couple of seconds there, I thought you were going to shoot me."
"I thought you were somebody else."
"The priest?"
The gunslinger looked up sharply. "What priest?" The boy looked at him, frowning lightly.
"The priest. He camped in the yard. I was in the house over there. I didn't like him, so I didn't come out. He came in the night and went on the next day. I would have hidden from you, but I was sleeping when you came."
He looked darkly over the gunslinger's head.
"I don't like people. They fuck me up."
"What did the priest look like?" The boy shrugged.
"Like a priest. He was wearing black things."
"Like a hood and a cassock?"
"What's a cassock?"
"A robe." The boy nodded.
"A robe and a hood."
The gunslinger leaned forward, and something in his face made the boy recoil a little. "How long ago?"
I...
Patiently, the gunslinger said, "I'm not going to hurt you."
"I don't know. I can't remember time. Every day is the same."
For the first time, the gunslinger wondered consciously how the boy had come to this place, with dry and man-killing leagues of desert all around it. But he would not make it his concern, not yet at least. Make a guess. Long ago?
No, not long. I haven't been here long.
The fire lit in him again. He grabbed the can and drank from it with hands that trembled the smallest bit. A snatch of the cradle song recurred, but this time, instead of his mother's face, he saw the scarred face of Alice, who had been his woman in the now-defunct town of Tull. How long? A week? Two? Three? The boy looked at him distractedly.
Yes.
Which one?
A week or two. I didn't come out. He didn't even drink. I thought he might be the ghost of a priest. I was scared. I've been scared almost all the time.
His face quivered like crystal on the edge of the ultimate destructive high note.
He didn't even build a fire. He just sat there. I don't even know if he went to sleep.
Close. He was closer than he had ever been. In spite of his extreme dehydration, his hands felt faintly moist, greasy.
There's some dried meat, the boy said.
All right. The gunslinger nodded. Good. The boy got up to fetch it, his knees popping slightly. He made a fine, straight figure. The desert had not yet sapped him. His arms were thin, but the skin, although tanned, had not dried and cracked. He's got juice, the gunslinger thought. He drank from the can again. He's got juice, and he didn't come from this place. Jake came back with a pile of dried jerky on what looked like a sun-scoured breadboard. The meat was tough, stringy, and salty enough to make the cankered lining of the gunslinger's mouth sing. He ate and drank until he felt logy and then settled back. The boy ate only a little. The gunslinger regarded him steadily, and the boy looked back at him. "Where did you come from, Jake?" he asked finally.
"I don't know."
The boy frowned.
"I did know. I knew when I came here, but it's all fuzzy now, like a bad dream when you wake up. I have lots of bad dreams."
"Did somebody bring you?"
"No," the boy said. "I was just here."
"You're not making any sense," the gunslinger said flatly. Quite suddenly, the boy seemed on the verge of tears.
"I can't help it. I was just here. And now you'll go away and I'll starve because you ate up almost all my food. I didn't ask to be here. I don't like it. It's spooky."
"Don't feel so sorry for yourself. Make do."
"I didn't ask to be here,"
the boy repeated with bewildered defiance. The gunslinger ate another piece of meat, chewing the salt out of it before swallowing. The boy had become part of it, and the gunslinger was convinced he told the truth. He had not asked for it. It was too bad. He had asked for it. But he had not asked for the game to become this dirty. He had not asked to be allowed to turn his guns on the unarmed populace of Tull. Had not asked to shoot Allie, her face marked by that strange, shining scar. Had not asked to be faced with a choice between the obsession of his duty and his quest, and criminal amorality. The man in black had begun to pull bad strings in his desperation, if it was the man in black who had pulled this particular string. It was not fair to ring in innocent bystanders and make them speak lines they didn't understand on a strange stage. Allie, he thought, Allie had at least been into the world in her own self-illusory way, but this boy, this goddamned boy... "Tell me what you can remember," he told Jake.
"It's only a little. It doesn't seem to make any sense anymore."
"Tell me. Maybe I can pick up the sense."
"There was a place, the one before this one, a high place, with lots of rooms and a patio where you could look at tall buildings and water. There was a statue that stood in the water."
"A statue in the water?"
"Yes, a lady with a crown and a torch."
"Are you making this up?"
"I guess I must be," the boy said hopelessly. There were things to ride in on the streets, big ones and little ones, yellow ones, a lot of yellow ones. I walked to school. There were cement paths beside the streets, windows to look in, and more statues wearing clothes. The statues sold the clothes. I know it sounds crazy, but the statues sold the clothes.
The gunslinger shook his head and looked for a lie on the boy's face. He saw none.
I walked to school.
The gunslinger shook his head and looked for a lie on the boy's face. He saw none.
I walked to school, the boy repeated fixedly, and I had a...
His eyes tilted closed and his lips moved gropingly.
A brown book bag. I carried a lunch, and I wore...
The groping again, agonized groping.
A tie.
A what?
I don't know.
The boy's fingers made a slow, unconscious clinching motion at his throat, a gesture the gunslinger associated with hanging.
I don't know. It's just all gone.
And he looked away. May I put you to sleep? The gunslinger asked.
I'm not sleepy.
I can make you sleepy, and I can make you remember. Doubtfully, Jake asked.
How could you do that?
With this. The gunslinger removed one of the shells from his gun belt and twirled it in his fingers. The movement was dexterous, as flowing as oil. The shell cartwheeled effortlessly from thumb and index to second and ring to ring and pinky. It popped out of sight and reappeared, seemed to float briefly, and then reversed. The shell walked across the gunslinger's fingers. The fingers themselves moved like a beaded curtain in a breeze. The boy watched, his initial doubt replaced with plain delight, then by raptness, then by a dawning mute blankness. The eyes slipped shut. The shell danced back and forth. Jake's eyes opened again, caught the steady, limpid dance between the gunslinger's fingers for a while longer, and then his eyes closed once more. The gunslinger continued, but Jake's eyes did not open again. The boy breathed with steady, bovine calmness. Was this part of it? Yes. There was a certain beauty, a logic, like the lacy frettings that fringe hard blue ice packs. He seemed to hear the sound of wind chimes. Not for the first time, the gunslinger tasted the smooth, loden taste of soul sickness. The shell in his fingers, manipulated with such unknown grace, was suddenly undead, horrific, the spoor of a monster. He dropped it into his palm and closed it into a fist with painful force. There were such things as rape in the world, rape and murder and unspeakable practices, and all of them were for the good, the bloody good, for the myth, for the grail, for the tower. Ah, the tower stood somewhere, rearing its black bulk to the sky. And in his desert-scoured ears, the gunslinger heard the faint, sweet sound of wind chimes. "Where are you?" he asked. Jake Chambers is going downstairs with his book bag. There is earth science, there is economic geography, there is a notepad, a pencil, a lunch his mother's cook, Mrs. Greta Shaw, has made for him in the chrome and formica kitchen where a fan whirs eternally, sucking up alien odors. In his lunch sack he has a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, a bologna lettuce and onion sandwich, and four Oreo cookies. His parents do not hate him, but they seem to have overlooked him. They have abdicated and left him to Mrs. Greta Shaw, to nannies, to a tutor in the summer, and the school, which is private and nice and most of all white, the rest of the time. None of these people have ever pretended to be more than what they are, professional people, the best in their fields. None have folded him to a particularly warm bosom, as usually happens in the historical novels his mother reads, and which Jake has dipped into, looking for the hot parts. Hysterical novels, his father sometimes calls them, and sometimes bodice-rippers.
"You should talk," his mother says with infinite scorn from behind some closed door where Jake listens. His father works for the network, and Jake could pick him out of a lineup. Probably. Jake does not know that he hates all the professional people, but he does. People have always bewildered him. He likes stairs and will not use the self-service elevator in his building. His mother, who is scrawny in a sexy way, often goes to bed with sick friends. Now he is on the street. Jake Chambers is on the street. He has hit the bricks. He is clean and well-mannered, comely, sensitive. He has no friends, only acquaintances. He has never bothered to think about this, but it hurts him. He does not know or understand that a long association with professional people has caused him to take many of their traits. Mrs. Greta Shaw makes very professional sandwiches. She quarters them and cuts off the bread crusts, so that when he eats in the gym, period four, he looks like he ought to be at a cocktail party, with a drink in his other hand, instead of a sports novel from the school library. His father makes a great deal of money because he is a master of the kill, that is, placing a stronger show on his network against a weaker show on a rival network. His father smokes four packs of cigarettes a day. His father does not cough, but he has a hard grin, like the steak knives they sell in supermarkets. Down the street. His mother leaves cab fare, but he walks every day it doesn't rain, swinging his book bag, a small boy who looks very American with his blonde hair and blue eyes. Girls have already begun to notice him with their mother's approval, and he does not shy away with skittish little boy arrogance. He talks to them with unknowing professionalism and puzzles them away. He likes geography and bowls in the afternoon. His father owns stock in a company that makes automatic pin-setting machinery, but the bowling alley Jake patronizes does not use his father's brand. He does not think he has thought about this, but he has. Walking down the street, he passes Brendio's, where the models stand dressed in fur coats, in six-button Edwardian suits, some in nothing at all, some are bare-naked. These models, these mannequins, are perfectly professional, and he hates all professionalism. He is too young to have learned to hate himself yet, but that seed is already there. It has been planted in the bitter cleft of his heart. He comes to the corner and stands with his book bag at his side. Traffic roars by, grunting buses, taxis, Volkswagens, a large truck. He is just a boy, but not average, and he sees the man who kills him out of the corner of his eye. It is the man in black, and he doesn't see the face, only the swirling robe, the outstretched hands. He falls into the street with his arms outstretched, not letting go of the book bag which contains Mrs. Greta Shaw's extremely professional lunch. There is a brief glance through a polarized windshield at the horrified face of a businessman wearing a dark blue hat, in the band of which is a small, jaunty feather. An old woman on the far curb screams. She is wearing a black hat with a net. Nothing jaunty about that black net. It is like a mourner's veil. Jake feels nothing but surprise and his usual sense of headlong bewilderment. Is this how it ends? He lands hard in the street and looks at an asphalt-sealed crack some 2 inches from his eyes. The book bag is jolted from his hand. He is wondering if he has skinned his knees when the car of the businessman wearing the blue hat with a jaunty feather passes over him. It is a big blue 1976 Cadillac with 16-inch wheels. It is almost exactly the same color as the businessman's hat. It breaks Jake's back, mushes his stomach, and sends blood from his mouth in a high-pressure jet. He turns his head and sees the Cadillac's flaming taillights and smoke spurting from beneath its locked rear wheels. The car has also run over his book bag and left a wide black tread on it. He turns his head the other way and sees a large yellow Ford screaming to a stop inches from his body. A black fellow who has been selling pretzels and sodas from a pushcart is coming toward him on the run. Blood runs from Jake's nose, ears, eyes, rectum. His genitals have been squashed. He wonders irritably how badly he has skinned his knees. Now the driver of the Cadillac is running toward him, babbling. Somewhere a terrible, calm voice, the voice of doom, says, "I am a priest. Let me through. An act of contrition." He sees the black robe
and knows sudden horror. It is him, the man in black. He turns his face away with the last of his strength. Somewhere a radio is playing a song by the rock group Kiss. He sees his own hand trailing on the pavement, small, white, shapely. He has never bitten his nails. Looking at his hand, Jake dies. The gunslinger sat in frowning thought. He was tired, and his body ached, and the thoughts came with aggravating slowness. Across from him, the amazing boy slept with his hands folded in his lap, still breathing calmly. He had told his tale without much emotion, although his voice had trembled near the end when he had come to the part about the priest and the act of contrition. He had not, of course, told the gunslinger about his family and his own sense of bewildered dichotomy, but that had seeped through anyway. Enough had seeped through to make out its shape. The fact that there had never been such a city as the boy described, or if so, it had only existed in the myth of prehistory, was not the most upsetting part of the story, but it was disturbing. It was all disturbing. The gunslinger was afraid of the implications. Jake?
Uh-huh.
Do you want to remember this when you wake up or forget it?